Just before we begin today's episode, I wanted to take a moment to say an enormous thank you. You might not have noticed, but Cold Case Detective has just tipped over the 100,000 subscriber mark, which is honestly just unbelievable. Every like, every comment, every sub, and every view from every one of you means so much. I'm sure that you know that YouTube is not very friendly to the type of content we create, but your continued support proves that together we can still make an impact and keep telling these people's stories and spreading awareness. I believe that we have the greatest community on the platform. The interaction you guys leave, the comments are always so insightful and offer new ways of interpreting these cases and new avenues for us to explore. And your feedback is always so motivating and respectful and useful. We're looking into the logistics of a giveaway to celebrate the 100,000 subs milestone, so we'll get that out to you as quick as we can. It has been a great pleasure to take this journey with you, and I can't wait to see where it leads from here. Once again, thank you so much to everyone who likes, comments, subscribes, shares, or even just watches and enjoys what we do. You're the most important piece of keeping the channel going, and it's our mission to keep making content as long as you're ready to keep exploring these stories with us. It is a privilege to be here with you. So, once more, thank you so much, and keep an eye out for that giveaway coming soon. Now, with that said, let's dive into our first video as a Silver Play Button YouTube channel. Let's get going. We're all familiar with the bizarre ciphers left behind by the Zodiac Killer, and many of us have gazed in deep analysis at the ransom note found at the JonBenet Ramsey crime scene. As a matter of fact, letters linked with crimes aren't uncommon. Although many of those received by law enforcement, family, and journalists are weeded out and determined to be hoaxes, there are many that are considered, chillingly, to have come from the murderers themselves. In today's episode of Cold Case Detective, we'll be exploring two cold cases with strange, eerie letters. Beverly Potts. Beverly Rose Potts was born on April 15th, 1941, in Cleveland, Ohio, to Elizabeth and Robert Potts. She had one older sister named Anita, and the foursome lived together on Linnet Avenue in 1951. 10 years old at this time, Beverly was described as a shy, quiet, and responsible girl. She had a strong interest in the performing arts and was a trusted babysitter despite her young age, and tended to avoid interacting with strangers as much as possible, due to her shy and fearful nature. On August 24th, 1951, at around 7 p.m, Beverly, along with her friend and neighbour Patsy Swing, took her bike and headed along to Halloran Park, which was less than a quarter of a mile from where the girls lived. The pair had been given permission to visit a Showagon, a children's performance event that took place in the park every summer. This was a special treat for the girls, because the park was generally considered unsafe after dark. It was often filled with drifters, and the trees tended to block any light filtering from the streets and the stars above. At 8 p.m, the girls decided that the park would be much easier to maneuver if they didn't have their bikes, so they returned home to drop them off before heading back to the park. 45 minutes later, Patsy Swing suggested to Beverly that they begin the trip home, as Patsy had a 9 p.m. curfew. However, Beverly didn't need to be home until after 9, so she decided to stay in the park alone. Patsy left. She last saw Beverly in amongst the crowd, watching the on-stage performance. At 9:30 p.m, the show ended, and people began to empty out of the park. A 13-year-old boy who knew Beverly saw her heading diagonally across the park in a northeastern direction, about 150 yards from the corner of Linnet Avenue and West 117th Street. This made sense, as it was the quickest route home for the 10-year-old, and she would, when she reached the street, be just minutes away from her front door. Reportedly, the boy recognized Beverly by her distinct, quote, duck-like gait, as she walked with her toes pointed outward. Several witnesses claimed to have seen a girl who looked like Beverly near a black, battered 1937 Dodge, which was idling on West 117th Street. Inside the car were two men, to whom the girl was speaking. Witnesses placed this encounter between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m. The girl never entered the car at any point during these sightings. It's worth noting that Beverly was extremely shy around strangers, especially men, and would often flee rather than speak with them. So it seems odd that she would stop and talk to two unknown men in a car, if the girl was the soon-to-be-missing 10-year-old. It's possible that perhaps she knew the men, or that the girl wasn't Beverly at all. Beverly did not return home. At 10 p.m, her family began to search for her, but they had no luck and decided to contact the police department. The authorities launched a large search to find the missing girl, but found no trace. In the days following her disappearance, they went door to door canvassing the neighborhood and nearby areas. They traced suspicious cars, they searched in empty parking lots, and they used a plane to survey open railway cars. All of these efforts, however, proved fruitless. The case received extensive media coverage, which led to thousands of tips flooding the local police department. The family, including Anita, Beverly's 22-year-old sister, was cleared of any and all involvement in the disappearance. It was determined by investigators that Beverly had a stable life, was happy and well cared for, and had no apparent reason to run away, making it seem likely that she had been abducted. Shortly after her disappearance, her father's union offered a $1,000 reward, the equivalent of nearly $15,000 today. It was speculated that, given the 10-year-old's aversion to strangers, she had been perhaps lured into the home or car of someone she knew, maybe on the promise of a babysitting gig, or someone claiming they needed help running errands, or were ready to drive her home. This made it seem likely she was taken by someone local to the neighborhood. However, the only documented search of any nearby buildings was that of a search carried out in 1973 in the basement of what was then an auto shop. No evidence connected to Beverly's case was ever uncovered, however. There was also no plausible local suspect discovered in the months and years following the 10-year-old's disappearance. Another proposed theory was that although Beverly had been strongly warned against strange men, she hadn't been warned the same way about women, leading many to wonder if she was perhaps lured away by an unknown female. Although Beverly's case largely grew cold in the years following her disappearance, and leads have become scarce, there have been several suspects and confessions related to her vanishing. In 1955, a vagrant named Harvey Lee Rush told law enforcement in California that he had killed Beverly after luring her to a nearby bridge with sweets. However, he claimed to have killed her in 1952, a year after her disappearance, leaving 12 months unaccounted for. When he was extradited back to Cleveland, Rush admitted that he had lied, simply so he could return home to Cleveland. In 1980, two retired Cleveland detectives named James Fuest and Robert Shankland revealed that they knew the identity of the killer. According to them, in 1974, they were approached by a man who claimed his brother had sent him a letter admitting to the crime. His brother had fled Cleveland in 1966 after being charged with the abduction of two young girls. The brother was located by detectives and questioned, and he told them that he'd been living near the park in 1951 and made a habit of abducting young girls and sexually abusing them. He claimed that he didn't remember abducting Beverly in particular, but that he had flashes of memory involving a girl named Beverly. The detectives had been certain of his guilt ever since, but even with the letter that appeared to explain all, a lack of evidence meant that he was never charged in connection with Beverly's case. Another suspect in the disappearance of Beverly Potts was a man named William Henry Redmond, an Ohio native and former carnival worker. Redmond was indicted in 1988 for the murder of an 8-year-old girl in Pennsylvania in 1951. While in prison, he boasted about how he'd killed other young girls, but when he was questioned by authorities about Beverly, he refused to make a statement. Redmond was in the area at the time of the vanishing and had a record of child abuse convictions, which dated back to 1935, when he was just 13 years old. Despite the age of the case, it continued to turn up leads in the 1990s and 2000s. In 1994, a letter was found under the carpets of a Cleveland house in which a woman claimed that her husband had killed Beverly and that she caught him attempting to dispose of the body in their furnace. This letter had been written in 1960 and was found in a house on Midvale Avenue. The author of the letter was tracked down using real estate records, and she was 83 years old by the time she was traced in 1994. Her husband was already dead, and the woman admitted that the claims in the letter were false. She had written it as a revenge fantasy against her abusive husband. Then, starting in 2000, a reporter named Brent Larkin, who worked at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a local paper, began to receive letters pertaining to the case. The writer claimed he was an elderly man who wanted to confess to sexually abusing and killing Beverly before his death. He said he would turn himself in on the 50th anniversary of Beverly's disappearance, on August 24th, 2001. But he never did. He wrote another letter to apologize for this, claiming he'd been moved to a nursing home and wouldn't be able to honor his promise. Brent Larkin received four letters in total, with two containing details of the abduction and the slaying. One letter promised a sealed brown envelope and a rare coin that Beverly had in her purse the night she disappeared. These items were promised to Brent, but he has, as of 2020, yet to receive them. Authorities established that these letters were written by one person, likely an elderly, infirm man. However, they were never able to establish his identity. Some investigators believe that these interactions were genuine. In August of 2019, an unidentified person anonymously provided information about a suspect in the case. The police have checked this caller's information, and it all seems to add up, but they have stated that they need more information and have asked the same caller to please contact them again. The Crime Stoppers reward has been upped from $2,500 to $15,000. The eerie case of Beverly Potts has inspired multiple books and documentaries and is still being investigated nearly 70 years later. Anyone with any information is encouraged to contact Crime Stoppers at 216-252-7463. As of today, the mysterious and tragic case of Beverly Potts continues to go unsolved.
The commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
The Fort Worth Trio. Christmas 1974 should have been a joyous occasion, filled with love and laughter. But for three families in Fort Worth, Texas, there was a terrible tragedy which filled their days with grief and sadness. In December of 1974, Mary Rachel Trelica, who went by her middle name, was 17 years old. Rachel attended Southwest High School, and she'd been married for 6 months to Tommy Trelica, a handsome 21-year-old who had already been divorced and had a 2-year-old child. The couple had met when Tommy had been dating Rachel's 19-year-old sister, Deborah. Deborah and Tommy had been briefly engaged, but according to Deborah, the engagement was never serious and the split had been amicable. At the time of Rachel's disappearance, Deborah had temporarily moved in with her sister and brother-in-law, having recently fallen out with her own boyfriend. On December 23rd, 1974, Rachel and her 14-year-old friend, Lisa Renee Wilson, who also went by her middle name, planned to go Christmas shopping at the Seminary South Shopping Centre, now known as the Fort Worth Town Centre. In the morning, Renee went to her boyfriend's house to see if he wanted to come with them. Terry Mosley was 15 years old and lived nearby. During this meeting, he gave Renee a promise ring. The couple planned to attend a festive party later on that night. While Terry was unable to go, as he had prior commitments, his younger sister, Julie, who was just 9, overheard the conversation and asked if she could come instead. She didn't want to spend the day alone. Rachel and Renee were hesitant about allowing a 9-year-old to tag along and told her she could only do so if she got her mother's permission. Julie excitedly phoned her mother, Rayanne, to ask if she could go, but was told she couldn't as she didn't have any money. Rayanne later added that she didn't know Rachel, although she knew Renee, so initially didn't want her daughter to go on the trip. However, Julie continued to beg to be allowed to go, claiming she had no one else to play with, and her mother eventually relented, but told her to be home by 6 p.m. This would be fine, as Rachel and Renee intended to be home by 4, so Renee could get ready for the party with Terry. The trio piled into Rachel's 1972 Oldsmobile 98. They drove to the Army Navy store in Fort Worth, where Renee had some layaway items to collect. They then carried on to the shopping center at 4200 South Freeway in South Fort Worth. From this point on, however, the details of what the girls did becomes hazy. When none of the girls arrived home, their families quickly grew concerned. Some remained home in case the girls showed up, while others headed to the shopping center. Around 6 p.m, Rachel's Oldsmobile was discovered, locked, parked in the Sears upper level parking lot. It looked as if the girls had, at some point, made it back to the car, as there were a few gift items inside. The family waited by the car all night, desperately hoping for their return. However, the girls never came back. The next morning, the Fort Worth police were informed about the disappearance, and a search to locate the 3 girls was launched. Searchers combed through hundreds of back roads, creek beds, country roads, and the Texas brush, looking for any sign of life, but it never came. It didn't take long for the case to be handed over to the Youth Division of the Missing Persons Bureau, but the girls, for some reason, were deemed to be runaways. The families of each girl heavily disputed this. Renee's mother asked why Julie, a 9-year-old girl, would run away 2 days before Christmas. She also noted that her own daughter was very excited about the party she was supposed to attend the evening she went missing. Despite their frustrations with the authorities, the families of the missing trio handed out flyers and contacted newspapers across the country, desperately seeking help. This led to the case being well publicized, and tips and witness statements began flooding in. Around this time, a store clerk came forward to claim that an old woman had told her she had witnessed the girls being forced into a pickup truck near the Buddy's grocery store at the mall. The truck was never found, and neither was the witness, so the story could never be verified. The eeriest clue, however, came on December 24th, 1972, just 1 day after the girls went missing, when Rachel's husband, Tommy, received a letter in the mail. It read as follows, quote, "I know I'm going to catch it, but we had to get away. We're going to Houston. See you in about a week. The car is in the Sears upper lot. Love, Rachel." The letter was written in ink, while the envelope had been written on in pencil, and the sheet of paper was much wider than the envelope. The name Rachel was written on the top left corner of the envelope. But that's not all. It was addressed to Thomas, despite the fact that Rachel always called her husband Tommy, and it looked like Rachel's name had initially been misspelt. The L in her name was written as a lowercase e, and then gone over again to be corrected to an L. Neither Tommy nor Rachel's other family members believed that the 17-year-old had written the letter. The main clue gathered from the letter was the postmark, which contained no city, only a blurred postcode. It looked like it had read, quote, 76083, but that the three appeared backwards, possibly by a hand-loaded stamp, or perhaps it was a partial 8. It is assumed that the postcode is either 76083, which leads back to Eliasville near Throckmorton in Texas, or 76088, which is from Weatherford in Texas. Despite this information, no new leads appeared to emerge. During the 70s and 80s, the letter was subject to handwriting analysis. Even the FBI looked at it multiple times, but each time the letter was examined, the results came back as inconclusive. Reportedly, a week after the letter's arrival, the police told a local newspaper that the handwriting had been verified as Rachel's, but she may have been forced to write it. Then, in 1978, 6 years after the disappearances, police refuted these claims, stating that the results were inconclusive, and always had been. By the spring of 1975, the family were growing frustrated by the efforts of the police, and hired a private investigator named John Swaim. In April that year, Swaim and 100 volunteers went to the Texas city of Port Lavaca to search under bridges after he received a tip that the girls had been killed and dumped there, but no evidence was found to indicate that this was true. Later that year, in August, Swaim discovered that a 28-year-old man was making obscene phone calls in the area, and that this same man had worked for a South Fort Worth store where Rachel had applied for a job just before Christmas. Reportedly, this man, whose name does not emerge in online articles, had been abusing his position, gathering the information of women who had applied for jobs there, or who were listed as references on job applications. 6 women who'd handed in job applications were receiving the lewd phone calls. It's also noted that this man lived in the same neighborhood as Rachel's parents, but he moved away shortly before she married. Although this seemed like a promising lead, nothing ever came of it, and the man was never linked in relation to the trio's disappearance. Also in 1975, a young man claiming to be an acquaintance of Rachel's said he saw the trio in the record department store in the mall on the day they vanished. He claimed the girls were there with another person, and that he and Rachel spoke briefly. Around this time, women's clothing was located in the Justin area of Texas, but the items were found to not belong to the missing girls. A year later, in 1976, 3 skeletons were located in a field outside Alvord, Texas, by an oil drilling crew. The PI, Swaim, did have the remains compared to x-rays and dental records of the missing girl, but no match was made between them. It was later found that the remains were of 2 females and 1 male, aged between 15 and 17. In March of that same year, a psychic called one of the missing girl's family members and said that they could be found near an oil well. Desperate for any potential lead, searchers focused on a small oil drilling community named Rising Star, but this turned up nothing. Just a few short years later, in 1979, the case was plunged into darkness again when John Swaim died of a drug overdose, thought to have been brought on by his failing marriage. The death was ruled as suicide, and upon his death, he had ordered that all his case files be destroyed. And so they were. In the spring of 1981, police were called to a location in Brazoria County, Texas, when human remains were found in a swampy area. After a month of investigation, it was discovered that the bones did not match those of the missing trio. That same year, a witness came forward to claim that he saw a man in the parking lot of the shopping center forcing a girl into his van, but the witness was told by the man that it was a family dispute. This story was never verified by authorities. After this, the case grew cold. In 2001, it was reopened and assigned to a homicide detective who believes that the girls left with someone they trusted, and that more than one person was involved. In April of that year, a man named Bill Hutchins came forward. He was a security guard for the shopping mall's Sears outlet at the time of the girls' disappearance. According to Bill, he was working the late shift on December 23, 1972, when another guard in a pickup truck appeared around 1:30 p.m. The two exchanged harsh words, although it's unknown why. Bill reportedly saw three girls sitting in the front seat of the truck, with the youngest sitting next to the driver, and the oldest sitting next to the door. The man apologized for his language and drove off. Bill noted that the three girls were smiling and laughing and appeared to be there voluntarily. He claimed to have reported it at the time, but that no one ever got back to him. In the 2001 reopening of the case, however, this sighting was investigated, as was the other security guard who denied having anything to do with the girls. It was revealed that multiple people were being investigated as a part of the girls' disappearance. The most recent development in the case came in 2018, when two cars were pulled out of Benbrook Lake, Texas. The cars were suspected of having some connection to the trio's disappearance, but no forensic evidence was linked back to the girls. Several articles mention a third car, also submerged in the lake, which is being looked into, but there has been little to no information or updates since. During the 1990s, Rachel's brother, Rusty, gained a lot of attention when he and a private investigator named Dan James began working together. In 2000, the pair proposed the idea that Rachel, and Rachel alone, was still alive, and that she visited Fort Worth every Christmas. Dan James added that someone was, quote, shrouding and manufacturing evidence to keep her away. Rachel and Rusty's mother, Fran, blamed the PI for, quote, poisoning Rusty's mind, and Rusty fell out with his family due to his strange behavior and obsessive need to try and solve the case. He even demanded that his older sister, Deborah, take a polygraph test. A tragic example of the way these cases tear families apart. Fortunately, however, in recent years, the family has reunited. In the days following his wife's disappearance, Tommy put up a $2,000 reward for information leading to her whereabouts, but after a year, he left Fort Worth, took up a supervisory role at a Texas water company, and remarried. Renee's father continues to search for answers, although her mother, Judy, died in 2015 without any. Julie's mother also passed away in 2013 without ever knowing her daughter's fate. If alive today, Rachel would be 63, Renee would be 60, and Julie would be 55. If you have any information about the fate of these three girls, you can contact the Fort Worth Police Department at 817-469-8477. And there you have the facts. Two unsolved eerie cases with strange letters. Please leave a comment down below with your own theories and speculations, and remember to like this video and subscribe to support the channel. If you're still hungry for true crime content, you can check out the Cold Case Detective podcast by following the link below. Thank you for watching. Stay alert, stay safe, and I'll see you next time.